This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You get on a plane, you fly most of the night, you show up the next morning at the address they gave you, and you get to sit down with the president. Obama, free trade, and the TPP on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 3rd of June. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You can call it page-turning, if you like. You can call it changing the terms of the debate in Washington. That works, too. As does the very simple talking about what he wants to talk about. But call it what you will, President Obama is trying to get everybody's focus off the NSA and surveillance in Iran and back on free trade, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big 12-country trade agreement that is set to be taken up in the House in the next couple of weeks. Conventional wisdom is that it's going to be pretty tough sledding for the White House, that vote is. So that is where we started when I sat down with President Obama this morning in the Oval Office.
Mr. President, good to talk to you again, sir.
Great to be here.
So you spent the first couple of years of your presidency, as you say, trying to drag the economy out of a ditch. Here we are now, recovery's 5 years old, jobs are back, growth is back, and yet you have chosen an issue where you are arm wrestling members of your own party, you're aligning with the GOP who've spent 6 years throwing everything they can at you to stop you. Why this issue now?
Well, keep in mind that we started this issue 4 or 5 years ago. And in my trips to Asia, what became very clear is this is the fastest growing part of the world economy, the most populous, the most dynamic. And if we are not there helping to shape the rules of the road, then U.S. businesses and U.S. workers are going to be cut out because there's a pretty big country there called China that is growing fast, has great gravitational pull, and often operates with different sets of rules. So we started this negotiation, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, recognizing that a third of our recovery has been driven by exports, that typically, export industries pay higher wages. And if we want to make sure that we're selling American products, American services into the not just the next decade, but the next several decades, then we've got to have high standards, high labor protections, high environmental protections in that part of the market, that part of the world where we need to do business.
I get all that, and I understand it, but you brought up China, so I'm going to go there. China is the 800-pound gorilla that is not in this deal. You say you want to write the rules of trade for the global economy so that the Chinese don't. On the theory that this agreement is about our place in the global economy, how confident are you that the Chinese, who, as you know, do what they want, when they want, the way they want to do it, how confident are you that they're going to follow?
Well, they've already started putting out feelers about what the possibilities of them participating at some point.
To you?
To us, to Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary. The fact is that if we have 11 of the leading economies in the Asia-Pacific region who have agreed to enforceable labor standards, enforceable environmental standards, strong IP protections, non-discrimination against foreign firms that are operating, access to those markets, reduced tariffs, then China is going to have to at least take those international norms into account. And we are still pursuing strong bilateral economic relations with China. We still pressure them around issues like currency or the subsidies that they may be engaged in or theft of intellectual property. We still directly deal with them on those issues, but it sure helps if they are surrounded with countries that are operating with these same kinds of high standards that, by the way, we already abide by. So part of what we're doing here is we're leveling up as opposed to a race to the bottom, which means no labor protections, no environmental protections. We want to make sure that there's a level playing field. That's going to allow us to be successful and will help to shape trade and commerce, not just in the region, but in the world for a long time to come.
Let me get back to the American economy here for a minute. Economists generally agree, and I'll get some pushback here from economists who will hear this, but they generally agree that in the aggregate, free trade is a net plus. 20 years ago, the last time this country dealt with a big free trade agreement, it didn't work out well for a whole lot of people. Wages were lost, jobs were lost. Do you understand the pushback on that you're getting?
Absolutely. And I've said repeatedly publicly, there is a reason why you've got labor unions and some of my best friends in the Democratic Party concerned about any trade agreement. Because the truth is that globalization, advances in technology, big cargo containers shipping goods in that are sold through the distribution and logistics networks in this country, over the last 20, 30 years, played a role in reducing the leverage that workers had, played a role in outsourcing. But the argument that I make to my friends, whose values I share, is that you can't fight the last war. The truth is, today, if there is a company in the United States that wants to find low-wage labor, if that's their business model, I think it's a mistake, but if that's their business model, they can do it now under existing rules. NAFTA did not have labor protections or environmental protections that were enforceable. That was a side letter. So part of what I'm saying to our folks is that precisely because the existing rules oftentimes disadvantage U.S. workers and U.S. businesses, for us to create new rules that raise standards in an important part of the world, including, by the way, the two countries that were signatories to NAFTA, Canada and Mexico, so that now suddenly they've got to have stronger labor rules. If we've got potentially hundreds of millions of workers who are now subject to international labor standards that weren't there before, and now when we're working with them, even if they're not enforcing those standards 100%, we've got enough leverage to start raising those standards. That is good for us. So just because past experience raised concerns around outsourcing, we've got to think about the future and where our economy is now going. It's not going to be based on low-wage work. It's going to be based on high-skill, high-value-added, high-wage work, which we're good at. But that allows that means that we've got to be able to access those markets to sell those goods.
Which is based on a change in the American economy, and
yes,
we all know that, right? Now it's moving toward knowledge-based, it's moving toward innovation and away from manufacturing,
right.
But there's still a huge manufacturing base in this country. So that brings up this question. You know, a couple of weeks ago, in Oregon, you went out to Nike.
Right.
And you gave a long speech on the TPP, and you said, when the rules are fair, we win every time.
Right.
We win every time. And I get that you're using the presidential we here, right? The national we. But what do you say to the blue-collar worker who's lost wages over the past decade, who's lost perhaps a job, to the small business owner who's had to shut down? How do you say to that person, listen, this is really for the greater good here?
Well, no. But keep in mind that this is important not just for the Boeings of the world. This is important for small businesses and medium-sized businesses. They constitute the majority of exporters. And we know that wages are higher for firms that also are accessing international markets. And even the large firms like a Boeing have hundreds, maybe thousands of suppliers all across the country, many of them small and medium-sized businesses who benefit and who are able to hire more workers because they have access to these new markets. Nike's actually a great example. The truth is that the footwear industry in the United States got decimated. Now, part of that was technology. Part of it was globalization and much lower labor costs elsewhere. The reason I went to Nike is because They said that if this passes, they're in a position to bring 10,000 new jobs to the United States, partly because technology is now advancing, essentially 3D printing for footwear,
right,
where the labor costs per shoe are inherently lower because of technology. On the other hand, the need for knowledge, skills, reliability, all those design, all those things have increased. This is part of the reason why, since I came into office, we've seen the strongest growth in manufacturing since the 1990s. Part of that is we made some good decisions around the auto industry, but part of it is generally we're actually seeing insourcing as opposed to outsourcing. There are a bunch of manufacturers who are saying, you know what, it's actually smart for us to be in the United States. Low energy costs, great workers, great infrastructure, access to the largest market. So manufacturing has been growing faster during my presidency than at any time since the 90s, and faster than the overall growth of the economy. But even manufacturing's changed. It's not, you know, if you go into an auto company where it used to take 1,000 workers in a factory, now it might take 100. Those jobs aren't coming back regardless of where we go, because it really is due to technology. What we can do, though, is continue to expand our markets, and 95% of the world's marketplace is outside of the United States. We've got to have access to it.
I understand when you say that things have grown over your administration and that manufacturing is still solid in this country. One of the things I don't understand, though, and this is a larger free trade debate, which we have been having in this country for decades now, right, it is generally acknowledged to be a good, as I said before, and yet one never hears from proponents of free trade, yourself included, that there are losers. Full stop. There are losers.
I, the truth is, Kai, if you look over my interviews, you'll see I've said there are losers, and we have to take account of those losers. The question is, are there a lot more winners than losers? And the answer in this case is yes. But that doesn't mean that there is not going to be some impact on some sectors of the economy, by definition. That's going to be true anyway, by the way, but it may be that as a consequence of this trade deal, there are particular markets, there are particular niche parts of the economy where we've got to provide help to transition and to retool and adapt. That's part of the reason why part of this package includes trade adjustment assistance. But one of the basic premises for me in pursuing this is that we can't just draw a moat, pull up the drawbridge around our economy. We are completely woven into the global economy. We're the hub to many, to a large extent, of the global economy. So the question is, how do we construct a set of rules? But then also, how do we make sure that we're adapting and using the incredible advantages we have to the best of our ability? And so when I talk to labor leaders, for example, I say, you are absolutely right that there's been growing inequality, and some of that has to do with globalization and technology. The answer is not to not trade anymore. The answer is, how do we upgrade our skills? How do we make sure that the laws and the tax rules and how companies compensate their workers versus their CEOs, how are those rules fair? And if we do that well, then we can address those issues. But we're not going to address those issues by not trading with Japan. We're not going to address those issues by pretending that the global supply chain doesn't exist. The same is true when it comes to environmental issues. If we want to solve something like climate change, which was one of my highest priorities, then I've got to be able to get into places like Malaysia and say to them, this is in your interest. What leverage do I have to get them to stop deforestation? Well, part of the leverage is, if I'm in a trade relationship with them that allows me to raise standards, now they have to start thinking about how quick they're chopping down their forests and what kinds of standards they need to apply to the to environmental conservation. So we have to engage, not withdraw. And I think the big mistake that some of my progressive friends make when it comes to trade is not the values they're pursuing or the very legitimate concerns they have about some of past trade deals, the issue is, are you now identifying what's going to make the biggest difference in helping American workers compete and prosper? And that's not to shut off trade. That's designing good trade agreements and then doing the things that are fully in our control in this country, like raising our minimum wage, like making sure that we are providing job training and apprenticeship programs, making sure that our education system works, making sure we're investing in R&D, making sure we've got a fair tax system and we're closing corporate loopholes that allow us to fund things like infrastructure. All that stuff has to be at the center of our agenda.
Last thing, sir. There are a lot of issues in this free trade debate that play directly into the election next fall, right? Economic inequality, opportunity, the wealth gap. What do you figure the average American's economy looks like to them right now, the person making the median income, $53,000 a year?
I think they feel better than they did when I came into office. I think they feel somewhat more stable, but they are still traumatized by seeing their home values drop as fast as they did, by seeing their 401ks shrink, even though they've now more than recovered their value if they left those 401ks untouched. So they still have those memories of instability, and that's made them cautious. I also think that the long-term trend that predates the last economic crisis and predates my administration, which is incomes and wages flatlining at a time when corporate profits and the stock market have all been booming, and the winner-take-all elements of our economy have been entrenched, I think that continues to concern them. And my hope is that next year, part of what we discuss is how to combine a competitiveness and growth agenda with a inclusive, broad-based, middle-class economics agenda. And those things, I do not believe, are contradictory. Sometimes they get framed as either you're for free trade or you are for a strong worker voice. Either you are for the unfettered market or you are for a higher minimum wage. And my attitude is that we have to be for both. We have to compete in the world stage. The world is not slowing down. Technology is not stopping. And technology has probably had a bigger displacement effect on the economy than anything like trade has. So we've got to continually adapt. We've got to be nimble. We've got to be efficient. But we also have to be fair. And we have to give everybody access. And we've got to make sure that those at the very top are not using their economic wealth to influence the political process in ways that disadvantage middle class and working class folks. And if we do these things simultaneously, think about fairness, but also about growth and efficiency, that turns out to be the best recipe for growth and prosperity. And that's part of what has always been the hallmark of the American economy. When the middle class grows and there are ladders into the middle class and everybody's participating and income inequality and wealth inequality is not too skewed, that tends to be when we've got all cylinders clicking and we can compete against anybody.
Mr. President, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
President Obama in the Oval Office this morning. All of our coverage of the TPP and today's sit down with the president. Videos. We took our cameras with us. Some more audio. An explainer or three is all at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Coming up,
we attracted everybody who had failed in Sacramento, everybody who had failed in Phoenix, everybody who had failed in Las Vegas, everybody who had failed in Houston, and they all came here with unreal expectations.
Coming to terms with the oil bust in North Dakota, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, so whatevs wasn't really fair. The Dow Industrials up 64 points today, about 1/3%, closed at 18,076. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, 0.4%, ended things at 5,099. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, 21.14. Bank stocks on a roll. Bank of America bobbed up 1.5%. Citigroup rushed up 1 2/3% today. Burger chain Wendy's sizzled up 3.33%. The company raised its earnings growth target and said it plans to buy back about $1.5 billion in shares by the end of next year. Starwood Hotels and Resorts worldwide shined up 2.25% today. In bonds, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, get a load of this, everybody, up to 2.36%. Look out above. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its revised productivity and cost report for the first quarter. In Oakland, California, the NBA Finals get underway. The Cleveland Cavaliers versus the Golden State Warriors. And it's finally here. Tomorrow is National Cheese Day. Cheese pairs well with many things, including more cheese. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a point a couple, 4 or 5 years ago when we spent a lot of time on this program talking about uncertainty, about how nobody really knew what was going to happen. As the president and I were talking about earlier, that is mostly taken care of now, but it also means that is partly not taken care of. Out in Williston, North Dakota, there's a whole lot of not knowing what's going on happening right now, of not knowing whether the low oil prices and drilling collapse that they're in the middle of is going to turn into a real honest-to-goodness bust. Marketplace's Annie Baxter went out to see how people there are trying to plan around that lasting uncertainty.
Dan Kalile has seen several rounds of oil booms and busts in North Dakota. He's a trim fellow with glasses and a cowboy hat, and he remembers how his dad, a banker, got stuck with loans that soured after a burst of drilling in the 50s.
He and the president of the bank were selling oil field equipment every day for 10 cents on the dollar.
Then there was another boom-bust cycle in the early 80s. Kalile had to confront its aftermath directly, including in his current role as a county commissioner.
It took until just a few years ago for the city of Williston to pay off its debt from that boom, from pushing infrastructure out for developers who were going to come and build and then didn't show up.
In the last decade, new fracking technologies brought oil rigs roaring back to life in North Dakota. And Dan Kalile nervously watched developers descend once again.
We attracted everybody who had failed in Sacramento, everybody who had failed in Phoenix, everybody who had failed in Las Vegas, everybody who had failed in Houston, everybody who failed in Florida. And they all came here with unreal expectations.
Kalile says Williston is now $300 million in debt for once more building up infrastructure around the boom time developments. He fears Williston has overreached, especially since global demand for oil is expected to be muted over the next few years. But a lot of other people around Williston seem more confident about the town's future.
The motion is to run with this for approval. Okay, roll call.
A proposal for a $500 million mall and hotel development in Williston cleared some big hurdles in county planning committee meetings over the past few months.
5-4, passes.
The developer is a Swiss-based company called Stropik. It announced the project last year when oil was trading about $40 a barrel higher than it is today and more than twice the current number of drilling rigs were operating in North Dakota. But Stropik's Terry Olin says the oil industry will snap back at some point, so he's moving ahead with his plan.
If we were to try to time each stage of it with oil price fluctuations, we'd never get any place. And whatever price oil is, it's temporary, high or low.
Real estate economist Elliot Eisenberg says building a mall in North Dakota's oil patch right now is not entirely crazy if you're not in a rush to make money.
Some investors with very long time horizons might say, look, labor costs are now lower, land prices are lower. We can actually build a project right now and decide that, yeah, we're prepared to sit on it for 2 or 3 years and see what happens.
That said, Eisenberg thinks there are big risks given the weak forecast for oil demand. And he points to another big variable. How many kids and spouses of oil field workers will settle in the area? That question has already vexed the school district, and it could thwart big mall projects like Stropik's. So says Tom Rolfsted, Williston's former director of economic development. He's generally upbeat about the town's future and thinks it's just going through a slowdown, not a full-on bust. But Rolfsted acknowledges retail needs permanent residents to thrive, and many oil field workers around Williston are temporary.
A lot of people live there, rotate back somewhere else, and they spend their money on their house back in whatever state they came from. So that is maybe hurts us a little bit.
Even if the oil boom regains its steam and Williston attracts more workers who will throw down roots, Dan Kalile, the Williams County Commissioner, may not rest easily. While he fears Williston's got another bust on its hands, he doesn't exactly want another boom. It would mean gobs more people, traffic, crime.
The one complaint you hear over and over again about this oil boom is that our time has been stolen from us. This was a five-minute town. This was a town where in 5 minutes you could hit the gas station, the grocery store, the dry cleaners, the bank, and be on your way.
It was a town, Kay Lyle says, that used to be so easy to live in. In North Dakota's Oil Patch, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, back to where we started, President Obama and the TPP. One of the things I didn't get to, because honestly, the 15 minutes that you get with the guy goes by pretty quick. Anyway, one of the things was the flack that the White House is getting for not letting people, which is to say critics of the deal, see the text of the thing as it's being negotiated and then being able to have an open debate on the merits about it. Well, WikiLeaks has a proposition for you. The group has offered a $100,000 bounty to anybody who can get them a copy of the thing. They are crowdsourcing that reward, by the way. So far, they've got about $38,000 of it covered. Don't know if that makes a difference to you. We have all of our coverage of my talk with the president today, minus the WikiLeaks part, I should say, at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. Let me get the plug in one more time. All of our coverage of the president's conversation with us today, the video as well. We took cameras in with us. At marketplace.org. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Risnall. We will see you back in LA tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.